ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Good morning. Happy New Year. Welcome to AM. I'm David Lipson, coming to you from Gadigal land in Sydney. The world is continuing to ring in the new year. Australia, as always, one of the first places to welcome 2026, with revellers all over the country celebrating in backyards, towns, and our sparkling cities. In Sydney, crowds observed a minute of silence in the wake of the Bondi terror attack. Julia Bergen reports.
Sydney brings in the new year with its world-famous fireworks display. More than a million people watch on from dozens of vantage points across the city as more than 9 tonnes of pyrotechnics light up the sky. People from across the world lined up for hours to secure the best spots to view the dazzling display. And they weren't disappointed.
So spectacular, the best place in the world.
It was another tick on my bucket list.
Actually, this was my dream, to stay in Australia to see these fireworks. So now I'm here, so I'm so excited to see it.
I think it's just like a once-in-a-lifetime experience. Like, I'm never going to be here again and watch the fireworks.
Being one of the first in the world to look at the fireworks, so that's the most exciting part.
But this year, it was also a somber moment. Sydney residents, especially the Jewish community, continue to mourn in the wake of the Bondi terror attack. During New Year's celebrations, a menorah was projected into the pylons of the Harbour Bridge. And there was a minute's silence at 11 p.m. in memory of 15 people who were killed in the mass shooting.
We decided to stand up and pay our respect and make a moment of silence. We want to come out from what happened in Bondi and celebrate and, you know, pay the respect to the people who lost their loved ones.
Security was ramped up along the harbour. A record number of police officers were on patrol in Sydney. More than 2,500 were deployed to the main fireworks viewing areas, with some carrying heavy weaponry.
There's a lot of security around as well, which feels, I mean, while it is sad, but for us, we feel a bit more safer seeing a lot of police around.
This time, if you can see, the security has managed, like, they're acing it. Like, it's not that crowded as it was before. People are fearing, obviously, what they all went through.
I was a little bit apprehensive. I thought, you know, a mass of people today in Sydney, you never know, do you? That's the problem. You can't put your life on hold, can you?
Yeah.
You have to keep living.
In his New Year's message to the country, Prime Minister Anthony Albanese encouraged people to look ahead with hope to 2026.
Following the terror inflicted on Jewish Australians at Bondi Beach, our hearts ache for every life lost and every life changed forever. Yet what Bondi also showed us was the best of the Australian spirit in all its courage and compassion. And that is why I'm optimistic and determined that in the new year we will rise to meet the challenges ahead of us.
There were also large fireworks displays in other major Australian cities as revellers partied past midnight. 500,000 people took part in Melbourne. While across Australia, people looked back on 2025. For some, in the regional Victorian city of Bendigo, the year's high points were much more personal.
I think getting fit. I'm at Lake Waroona at the moment, walking with my friend and going to strength and balance classes, and I'm over 70 and it's made the world of difference.
Probably finding out we're in the queue for permanent residency. It's just being assessed by the government and then we'll just wait and see.
Well, I've given up on losing weight and I've given up on the gym, so let me see. Drink more French champagne, I think.
Classic. A New Year's Eve reveller ending that report by Julia Bergen. As the Albanese government grapples with the aftermath of the Bondi terror attack, previously secret cabinet documents reveal details about how the Howard government was working to mitigate concerns about a homegrown terrorist threat 20 years ago. Hundreds of records from 2005 have been made public in the National Archives annual release, showcasing revelations from Australian politics at the time. Political reporter Romy Stevens with this story.
2 decades ago, violent race riots broke out in Cronulla, south of Sydney.
Aussie, 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 Aussie.
incited by a fight between surf lifesavers and young men of Middle Eastern background a week earlier. The riots exposed deep racial tensions amongst the community.
Telling the leps to go home, stop making trouble down the beach.
Retaliation attacks led by Middle Eastern Australians added to the violence over 2 days of unrest. Previously secret cabinet documents are now revealing government concerns around extremism and social cohesion that year, particularly after terrorist bombings in London and Bali. Philip Ruddock was the Attorney General at the time with a seat at the cabinet table.
It was the most difficult period that we had experienced for decades.
In a submission to Cabinet, the 2005 Multicultural Affairs Minister John Cobb had said the London bombings were perpetrated by mainly locally born and raised young Muslims. He highlighted the potential for radicalisation in Australia. That year, efforts were made to create a greater sense of inclusion among young Muslim Australians, and the government expanded anti-terrorism law enforcement powers. Philip Ruddock says action was necessary.
We needed to be ensuring that terrorism was effectively prosecuted and dealt with, but we needed to be able to ensure that Australians of different races, different cultures, different religions would function as one.
Tensions also brewing in 2005 over industrial relations reforms. The Howard government, at the peak of its power with a majority in both houses of parliament, passed the controversial Work Choices legislation. The workplace relations minister at the time, Kevin Andrews, had said the reforms were likely to elicit strong opposition from unions, but employers will react positively. Cabinet historian David Lee says the government didn't end up getting the support it wanted from the business community.
And the campaign by the unions particularly proved to be very, very successful.
In 2005, immigration under the Howard government returned to the spotlight following the unlawful detention of dual citizen Cornelia Rau. An inquiry by former Australian Federal Police Commissioner Mick Palmer found serious cultural problems within the Immigration Department. Philip Ruddock reflects on what he says was one of the faults of the Howard government.
In looking so closely at budget expenditure, a lot of initiatives that should have been put in place to better handle the large number of unauthorised arrivals were overlooked.
Strengthening bilateral relationships also front of mind. A submission to the National Security Committee suggested the redeployment of troops to Afghanistan may enhance already strong relationships with the United States and the United Kingdom. NSC agreed to deploy a Special Forces Task Group, a move John Howard defended at the time.
We think it's important that the progress made in Afghanistan is preserved and consolidated.
15 years later, a landmark inquiry would find credible information of war crimes committed by Defence Force personnel in Afghanistan between 2005 and 2016.
Romy Stevens reporting. Israel is banning dozens of major aid organisations, including some of the world's best-known charities, from working in the occupied Palestinian territory, saying many won't hand over details of their local staff for new registration requirements. The agency said the ban will have a catastrophic impact on services delivered to Palestinians, particularly in the Gaza Strip, where Israel has destroyed most of the housing and infrastructure, and the population relies on aid. Middle East correspondent Eric Torchek with more.
In the Zaytun camp in northern Gaza, displaced Palestinians live in tents surrounded by the ruins of Gaza City. Heba Dahdou is one of many homeless Gazans who say they rely upon international aid agencies for food, shelter and medical care. And she's afraid about what will happen when Israel blocks major charities from operating there.
Our entire life will collapse. Everything will stop. We'll go back to hunger, siege and destruction. Our lives will become even harder than before.
Heba Dahdou's neighbour, Hossam Dalul, says he specifically relies on these charities for medical care.
If they stop, we can't live. They are our only support. They send us tents, soup kitchens, schools, kindergartens for children. If these institutions stop, we will collapse even more than we already have. I am injured. If these agencies stop, where will I get my treatment and painkillers? How will I get them? My situation will become even worse.
The Israeli government says 37 organizations are being refused registration under its new rules for aid groups because they won't submit personal details of staff and their families. A further 9 have been blocked for other reasons. The organisations blocked include Doctors Without Borders, Save the Children, Oxfam, Caritas, ActionAid, the International Rescue Committee, and World Vision. Oxfam's humanitarian coordinator for the Middle East and North Africa, Ruth James, says the impact upon services in Gaza will be enormous.
This will impact every aspect of the humanitarian response, which includes many sectors. So we're talking about water, health, nutrition, food, education, things that are basic rights of people to have will become even more limited. And as a result of this,
the Israeli government says the impact on aid in Gaza will be minor. It says the banned organizations only account for 1% of the total amount of aid entering the Strip. But that doesn't mention the services delivered by these groups, or that the reason they're not bringing aid into Gaza at present, they say, is because Israel is preventing them.
In fact, all of our many, many requests to bring our humanitarian goods into Gaza since, I think, March this year have been denied, including very recently. And those items include food in Jordan, sanitary pads for women, very basic and essential items.
The aid groups say they can't supply details of their staff because it breaches European laws and humanitarian principles and could expose their colleagues to harm, given Israel has killed hundreds of Palestinian aid workers inside Gaza. Ravina Shamdasani, the spokeswoman for the UN High Commissioner for Human Rights, says these latest bans compound the existing obstruction of aid organisations by Israel.
Israel's suspension of numerous aid agencies from Gaza is outrageous. This is the latest in a pattern of unlawful restrictions on humanitarian access, including Israel's ban on UNRWA, as well as attacks on Israeli and Palestinian NGOs amid broader access issues faced by the UN and other humanitarians.
The Israeli government says the agencies can still submit the details and apply for their registration after the deadline of January the 1st passes.
That's Middle East correspondent Eric Torchek. If you take a dip in your local pool this summer, you may be watched by something other than the lifeguards. AI-assisted technology is being introduced to public pools around the country in an effort to reduce drownings. It monitors swimmers for signs of distress and sends alerts to lifeguards. And Royal Lifesaving Australia says it's already proving to be a valuable tool. Here's Isabel Masali.
Drowning is often silent, but these lifeguards have a new alarm.
So this red dot is a GPS location of exactly where the alert is coming from. And then I can slide to the left and see one image of what the alert is for.
Duncan Hutton has overseen the introduction of this AI-based technology at the City of Stirling in Perth. It uses a swimming pool's existing CCTV and sends alerts to smartwatches if a swimmer goes underwater for too long, stops moving, or seems to be struggling.
This system is really a superpower, an additional tool for our lifeguards. We're not replacing anyone. You still need the lifeguard to actually respond to the incident.
It's been in place at this Inglewood pool for about a year. But a few months ago, there was a significant rescue,
which our lifeguard got notified initially by the incident. Now, luckily, during the rescue, we had a member of the public actually swim over the top of it. But by having this system, our lifeguard was there pretty much a few seconds after that initial person was able to get the rest of the team to also assist in the rescue very, very quickly, and that had a positive result.
Absolutely, this is going to become something that becomes the norm at pools all across Australia.
That's RJ Houston from Royal Lifesaving Australia. The organisation is studying the impact in a research partnership with Linksight, the most popular brand of such software.
It is early days. We're seeing the technology rolled out at about 120 facilities nationwide. These systems are providing thousands of prompts to lifeguards about potential drowning incidents. And so in some cases, there's been at least two in the last few months that have been significant interventions that have definitely prevented a drowning from occurring.
So far, he's noticed another powerful benefit.
We're already finding from our research that lifeguards are finding that it's easing their stress. So they have what we call chronic unease, where they come into work and they're constantly in a state of elevated stress because of the risk that someone could drown on that shift. And so having this extra layer of support, we're already seeing in the sort of psychosocial impact research that we're doing, that lifeguards are feeling more confident, pool managers are feeling more confident, everyone is sleeping a little bit better at night, the night before a shift.
Paul Salmon is a professor of human factors at the University of the Sunshine Coast. He's not involved in the project, but the new tool has captured his attention.
You know, it's one of the more positive uses of AI, and specifically because I think the intention is to assist humans in doing their job. And it's obviously seems to be a technology that is working and can work.
Having said that, he does have some hesitations.
I think there needs to be careful thought about how we manage some of those associated emergent risks as people increasingly use the technology. So, you know, how are we going to prevent over-reliance on the technology? How are we going to prevent skill degradation in lifeguards?
Royal Life Saving says it's committed to ensuring there are appropriate systems in place so complacency doesn't set in, and has created training for lifeguards that will soon roll out nationwide. Back at the pool, these swimmers are pretty supportive.
I think it's a great idea because there's eyes everywhere and, yeah, extra set of eyes.
That's good, but remember that point. Your lifesavers still need to be trained. They still need to be strong swimmers.
I think anything that helps save lives and helps people from not drowning, I think, is a great idea. I actually didn't know until today, but now that I do, I guess I feel a bit safer in the pool.
That's a swimmer at Perth's Inglewood Pool, ending that report by Isabel Masali. Well, waking up on New Year's Day, there are sure to be a few sore heads around the country. Researchers say while most people know not to drive home drunk, the same awareness doesn't always apply to next day drink driving. Louise Mylan with the story.
Angus and Sean are mates in their 20s. They say they'd never drive home after a night out.
Try and public transport there, but ride share on the way back for sure.
But the morning after, it's a different story.
I know for me personally, if I'm trying to save, I'll try and drive.
The mates from Melbourne often leave cars at a venue or a friend's place and drive home in the morning.
I've stayed at Gus's house plenty of times.
But it's not always the safest option. Research from the University of the Sunshine Coast found 60% of drivers between 18 and 25 admitted to driving the morning after binge drinking. Michelle Nichols is the lead researcher and says there's a good chance many could be drink driving.
It really seems that young drivers just aren't aware of the risks associated with the behaviour, and they might just have limited knowledge on the lasting effects of residual alcohol as well.
While the legal blood alcohol limit for full licence holders is 0.05%, L and P platers are not allowed any alcohol in their system. Alcohol leaves the body at a rate of roughly one standard drink per hour, but that timing varies between different individuals. Michelle Nichols says many young people are unaware of the risk or see driving the day after drinking as normal.
Next day drink driving was reported significantly more than drink driving.
While ditching cars entirely would be ideal, Sean and Angus feel the cost of alternative transport is too expensive.
It could be like $20, $20, $20, and then like, then you get the DD home. That's like 200.
It's not just young people who get behind the wheel after a big night. Last month, Yorick Piper, the husband of the Victorian Premier, was apprehended for drink driving the morning after celebrations at a Bendigo pub. Premier Jacinta Allen was forced to address the embarrassing incident.
He as a result has received an on-the-spot fine and lost his licence for 3 months.
In Queensland, there's been more than 300 deaths on the roads this year, nearing a two-decade high for the state. Michael Kane is from the Royal Automobile Club of Queensland, or RACQ.
3 in 4 Queenslanders admit to drinking more than they planned to before they drove.
In WA, double demerits are enforced for drink driving offences over the holiday period, and across the country, police are ramping up breath testing operations. Researcher Michelle Nichols says it's a timely reminder that drink driving isn't always limited to a night out.
People probably don't really realise that it's an actual issue and it can actually happen.
Angus and Sean say they'd welcome more public awareness too.
Growing up, I remember all the ads around alcohol and driving, and I think it's coming back a bit.
probably could build more awareness around that.
That's 21-year-old Angus ending that story from Louise Mylan. And that's AM for today. Thanks for your company. Happy New Year. I'm David Lipson.